Hello, and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 36 for February 9th, 2010. My name is David Liu, and with me today are...
Dominic Rabe.
Ben Snakoff.
And David O'Brien.
So we've got 3.5 great stories for you today, starting with an update from podcast 35 about Amazon and Macmillan Publishing. So what have we learned since last week about this case or this situation?
Shortly after we finished recording the podcast, Amazon rolled over and said, you know what, we're going to put Macmillan's books back on the website. We're going to, accede to their demands that they be able to set the prices of their books, and we're just going to move on. And initially, Amazon didn't actually put all of the books back on their website, but last I had heard, and this is as of Saturday, they did in fact have all of Macmillan's books back up on the website, and everything was continuing as usual.
It's really a shame that story didn't post like an hour earlier, because I think that popped right up on our radar right when we finished recording, too.
Yeah, it did. It was within an hour of when we finished.
Now, we probably shouldn't talk about this too much just because we're treating it as just a quick update, but I was a little disappointed to see them accede to Macmillan's demands, and I wonder what the effect is going to be then on all the other publishers, which also have their books in the Amazon store. But maybe it doesn't have any effect. It probably depends a lot on what's in the contracts. We still have to worry about those possible antitrust claims regarding, using either restrictive clauses in contracts or, trying to control or using this portal that they have for the Kindle and all their other books on Amazon as sort of a way to restrict, the sale of books.
Yeah, if we get anything out of this, it's going to be that publishers are going to be able to control their own prices better, and they're going to be able to institute a tiered pricing where when the book comes out, they're going to be able to charge more for it. And, when the trade paperback and when the mass market paperbacks come out, they're going to be able to reduce the ebook pricing accordingly, which, price discrimination, it's fair. It kind of sucks, especially for something with the electronic version where all you're getting is quicker access to it as opposed to an actual higher quality product, but... Yeah, that's the way it goes.
Yep, pretty much. And, I think like I commented last week that Macmillan really had a pretty strong leveraging position right after the iPad had been announced, and also after Apple had announced their, iBook store? And in order to, have those different ways to price books as they come out per publishers. So it was just another channel to release books.
Yeah, Apple announced the iBook eBook store, which is a mouthful in itself on the iPad.
Although we gotta say it's significantly better than the Nook eBook. I'm sorry, the Nook eBook.
That's true. I don't know what Barnes & Noble was thinking. But yeah, as a Kindle owner, I honestly prefer having the option of buying the book at a higher price now as opposed to having to wait. Instant delivery is pretty amazing, honestly.
All right, well, that transitions us pretty well into our first story today, which involves the iPad. And in case you've been living under a rock, the iPad is a versatile handheld wireless device that runs Windows CE. This is actually Fujitsu's product, the iPad, which is a retailing device that they've been producing for a number of years. There's also at least two other products called iPad. There's a MagTech product, which I believe is used for reading in credit cards, and ST Microelectronics also has a product called iPad, which is used for which stands for Integrated Passive and Active Devices. So, and then there is, of course, probably the most famous iPad, the one produced by Apple that was announced at a recent Apple press conference. So the overlap in trademarks here was a bit concerning. Recently there was a leaked memo from Fujitsu that some people were claiming is signs of an imminent lawsuit, which says that Fujitsu is aware of Apple's iPad announcement and possible infringement on our trademark, which has been in use in connection with Fujitsu mobile retailing computer products since 2002. We are currently discussing our options with our trademark counsel and have no further comment at this time. So what do you guys think? Does that mean imminent lawsuit?
Possibly. You know, when these leaked memos come out, first of all, unless a representative from the company or from Fujitsu's counsel comes out and actually acknowledges that that was in fact an internal memo and it was the official internal memo, I mean, you don't know how accurate those things are. That said, though, I think other people were aware when the iPad was finally announced that Fujitsu, at least, they were probably the most well-known out of this sort of grouping of products, did in fact have at least some rights to this mark called the iPad, and it had to do with a mobile handheld device as well. So that raised a lot of concerns for people, and this is something that's gone on with Apple in the past. Apple has a tendency to release products and then try to secure their intellectual property rights later, or sometimes they try to use like a back channel by registering the marks in other countries first, and then sort of transferring the rights to those marks in the U.S. And they do this because, and we'll discuss this a little bit too, to try to establish certain types of priority for marks. And based on the U.S. trademark system, if you have seniority in the use of your mark, then you technically have superior rights. But this Fujitsu product has been out for some time, and it's been used, and there's some issues also that have to deal with whether or not the mark was officially registered or whether or not it was abandoned. And it's an interesting story, I think, first of all. And there was a problem with the iPhone as well. There was another, I think it was a Cisco product that was also called the iPhone. They had, Cisco had registered the rights to that mark. And again, Apple, when they released their iPhone, had not secured the rights to the mark prior to releasing the product. And I think they do this because they don't like it to leak out to the press. They're a very secretive company when it comes to product releases, and so the press is constantly monitoring patent filings, they're monitoring trademark registrations to try to get an idea for companies like Apple that are really secretive of their products. So it's not really a huge surprise that Apple does this, but it's not necessarily to their advantage that they wait so long to register their marks. And what happened out of that Cisco and Apple dispute, I believe, was a sort of a private settlement that went on the side. I don't know if it actually went to litigation, but there was definitely a lot of talk about either it going to litigation. There were threats across both companies, and similarly, Fujitsu is going to be in a pretty much the same standing that Cisco was in, meaning that they had rights to this mark at least sometime before Apple did. So it could end up being a lawsuit.
Fujitsu actually never secured.
According
to
a press release on the Apple website, as of
go ahead.
Yeah, according to a press release on the Apple website, the Cisco and Apple are both, they just reached an agreement that they are both free to use the iPhone trademark, and whatever happens because of that, they'll just both deal with. So I guess it seems mutually agreed.
What I hadn't followed that as closely as I probably should have, but did they disclose whether there were any payments going back and forth, whether it was some sort of license to use the rights, or if it was this like, you know, a pretty generic press release that says, okay, it's not going to be a problem to use the iPhone mark, but what's really happening on the back end is that someone's paying another person, you know, being Apple paying Cisco to use the rights to use the mark.
It's pretty vague. It's pretty short as well. We can post a link to it afterwards, but it says that each side will dismiss any pending actions, blah, blah, blah. But the last sentence says other terms of the agreement are confidential. So that could mean pretty much anything.
Yeah, my personal guess is that there had to be some sort of compensation behind it.
My question, though, is even if there's compensation, you know, is there a licensing agreement here? Because if there is, you know, if either of them wants meaningful protection in that mark, they're going to need some sort of licensing agreement between them. And since Cisco owns the mark, they would have to have some sort of control over the quality of Apple's product, or at least some right to inspect to make sure that the product meets, you know, Cisco's standards to keep that mark protectable. Yeah, it doesn't seem like that's the kind of thing that Apple would be willing to give Cisco.
Well, I mean, it could depend on what's actually in the agreement. It was kept private, so we don't know what the terms of that agreement was, whether it was a licensing agreement or some other form of agreement, whereby they both parties abandoned rights to the mark, or you know, something along those lines. It could run the whole gamut of licensing schemes or just general agreements as they pertain to intellectual property in general.
In case you're wondering, the Cisco iPhone is actually a voice over IP device, as far as I can tell. So what claim does Fujitsu have here? I mean, do you think they'll be able to work out something with Apple like Cisco did, or do you think some sort of more forceful litigation is likely?
I think that's the big problem here. Well, the big problem here is that while the iPad Fujitsu's iPad has been on the market, they claim since 2002, they initially tried to proceed with a trademark registration and then stopped doing that until they caught wind of the fact that Apple was going to release this, and then they started it up again. So that doesn't totally preclude them from trying to go after Apple for this trademark infringement, but it's going to make it a lot more difficult on their part, because they're going to be stuck with what's called common law trademark protection as opposed to the statutory trademark protection.
Right, and it's probably really important to note here that you don't necessarily need to register a trademark in order to be able to use it and secure rights in it. As Ben just noted, you get common law rights based on the point in time where your first use in commerce is. So, assuming that Fujitsu did in fact start using that back in 2002, they at least have some rights to the mark. They do lose certain statutory protections and probably statutory damages as well, since they have not actually registered the mark. And another interesting question is whether or not they have abandoned any of those rights to the mark, either if they stopped using the mark for a period of time and showed some sort of express or implied intent to abandon the mark itself. Those are all questions which could be brought up, and Apple might be able to use some of those to contest any rights that Fujitsu might have.
Right, and the second problem Fujitsu is going to have is whether or not they actually have established that they have, you know, any type of trademark protection or even strong trademark protection. The basis of what the analysis is whether or not there's going to be a likelihood of confusion. Would somebody who picks up the Apple iPad and look at it think that it, or you know, see an advertisement for it, think that they were getting the Fujitsu iPad? And there are a lot of factors that go into that. They're generally called the sleek craft or the Polaroid factors, and they vary slightly from one federal circuit court of appeals to another. But generally, you have things like who are the customers, and in this case, the customers for the Fujitsu iPad are going to be corporations looking for point-of-sale devices, something where you can check people out. The iPad is a much more general device, you know, the strength of the mark. I don't think there's more than, you know, a few hundred people who have ever heard of the Fujitsu iPad before a couple of weeks ago, and now if you walk up to somebody on the street and ask them what the iPad is, I'm guessing the vast majority of them are going to say it's the Apple iPad, not the Fujitsu iPad. And there are a lot of other factors. I don't know if we want to go into each and every one of them and, you know, see which way it comes out, but yeah, Fujitsu is facing an uphill battle here.
In a case with confusion like that, I mean, if I was, say, running a business selling books, and I was using my iPad, or Fujitsu iPad, to track inventory, and then, you know, I advertised myself to whoever as a, you know, we use iPads to track our inventory. I mean, that's semi-ambiguous, because you could imagine a case where I was using an Apple iPad to track my inventory. And so, you know, if I said that to, I know, somebody taking over my company or, you know, my customers, does that count as sort of the case where confusion might happen, or is that too many degrees removed from the actual product?
Well, it depends a lot, again, on the actual use in commerce. What is the target market that you're trying to market your product that has that mark on it to? And that's something that is normally considered in the course of those likelihood of confusion cases, the Polaroid and Sleek Craft cases. And so that always plays in, of course, to any court's analysis and whether or not there is a case of actual infringement. Another interesting thing, though, sort of a corollary to what Ben was saying, is that although like you might go up on the street and ask somebody, do you know about the iPad? And they say, of course, it's this new Apple device that came out that, you know, some people think it's going to be great and other people don't really know what it is or not really sure if it's going to be successful. That said, though, if people start using if people are using these Fujitsu devices and they see the mark on their iPad, Apple might be concerned that there's some sort of confusion between that iPad usage and the usage of the actual Apple iPad, and whether or not there's any connection between the two devices. And you have, you know, Apple then is sort of worrying about the reputation that Fujitsu has with that mark that they're using in their mobile devices as it might pertain to the iPads themselves.
Yeah, this is a weird kind of like double reverse infringement. Reverse infringement is where you have someone, let's say there's a small company called that manufactured purely staples, and they were called Staples, and they made, oh, that's a terrible mark because that's not protectable at all.
awful example, Ben.
There's a company that made light bulbs, and they called themselves Insight, and then another company comes around, and they also call themselves Insight. And the second company that's called Insight is suddenly, you know, very famous. Sometimes you get this kind of reverse infringement lawsuit where the senior company that has the lower status is suing the older company for trademark infringement, where normally you think of trademark infringement as the bigger, older company suing the newer, smaller company.
So you brought up another interesting point about possibly pending dispute here, and that's genericide or using generic marks. And you know, that the reason that example with the staples is so awful is because it would be really difficult if you had a company that just made staples and you tried to use a mark or try to register and secure rights on a mark called Staples. And that mark, besides the fact that there's already a company out there that is actually based in the Boston area named Staples, let's forget about that for a moment, but if you try to do that, the mark is just merely descriptive, and you need to have some sort of secondary meaning that would be connotated connotated with the usage of the word staples and how it might relate to the company that's just producing staples. Similarly here, you have another possible problem with this use of the word I and then pad. Even though I think Apple's probably one of the first people to really have popular products that started like the iPod with that little I, lowercase I in front of it, the iBook, and then all the other iMac products that have come out. Those are generally considered by most people to be very generic marks, and just the usage, Apple has probably never been able to secure rights in just the use of that lowercase I because it is too generic. And you have then basically with the iPad, it's a four-letter word. And it's possible that word just is too generic overall, or it's just too descriptive overall, to be able to get rights in the mark.
Yeah, I find that argument a little tough to swallow, just because even if it's, I don't think it's flatly descriptive, and Apple has this knack of getting what's called acquired distinctiveness. It's when you've got a mark that normally wouldn't be strong enough, you know. It's kind of descriptive of what it is, or it's, you know, just kind of evokes the idea of what it is, of, you know, what the product is. Apple has this knack of getting what's called acquired distinctiveness, which allows you to register a mark, you know, instantly right off the bat after they introduce something, just because the onslaught of marketing is just so intense. You know, like I said, my guess is the vast majority of Americans know what an iPad is. It's been featured on newscasts. It's been in magazines already. It's been spoofed on SNL. At that point, chances are you're going to have acquired distinctiveness.
Yeah, I honestly think that Apple's going to prevail against Fujitsu here, partly because this is a little different than the Cisco case in that Fujitsu never actually secured the trademark. They only started trying to secure it again after they realized what Apple was about to do. Apple, however, was one step ahead of them and went to the Trademark Trial and Appeals Board, which governs this sort of thing, and said, hey, we'd like to extend the length of time that we can oppose Fujitsu's mark, and they successfully extended the proposal time three times, giving them until February 28th of this year to convince the Patent and Trademark Office one way or another that Apple actually owns iPad. And if they succeed in that by February 28th, then they'll walk away with the trademark and iPad, and Fujitsu will be left holding nothing.
Or at the very least, Fujitsu won't get the trademark. And Apple may not get it, but, you know, Fujitsu won't have it.
The one last interesting bit is, as David mentioned earlier, is that this trademark was actually registered to a company called IP Application Development in a number of different countries, including Trinidad, dating back to like July 2009, as a means of sort of trying to establish priority on this trademark. And there is some concern whether or not Apple will be able to more or less take that from this alleged company, IP Application Development, without any legal trouble, whether or not it's a legitimate business. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you can't. If you're going to set up a shell company, which is what Apple had tried to do in another country, just in order to establish registration of the rights, and then you get into this other area of international IP agreements and whether or not you can establish priority of rights in other countries. That's a whole other area. The problem with doing that is that you can't just set up a shell corporation just for the purpose of acquiring rights. Usually, it needs to be a legitimate company that stands on its own if it's going to be a branch of Apple, and before you can be able to transfer the rights like that. But that said, they can still probably establish that that's a valid branch of Apple as long as they use it for some other purpose, and it's still possible that they could transfer the rights that way. They still have the problem, though, that Fujitsu is claiming that they've used this mark in commerce since 2002. So the fact that they made this little shell corporation back in July 2009 might not have too much bearing on this case in particular, but it sort of depends on how the arguments pan out.
All right, any final thoughts on this one?
I'm all set.
All set.
I'm good on my end.
All right, our next story comes to us from Blue Mountain Middle School in Pennsylvania, where a particular student was disciplined for dress code violations and then got mad at their principal and decided that one way to blow off steam would be to create a fake MySpace page for roughly the principal. So it didn't use the principal's actual name or actual location, but it did use a picture of the principal from the school's website, and it also contained a lot of personal information that could pertain to the principal, such as, you know, the name of his wife, the fact that he had a kid, the fact that he was a middle school principal, that sort of thing. And so word got round about this MySpace page created by the student and one of her friends, and eventually word got to the principal himself. So the principal made the claim that this disrupted school activity, and in fact immediately the more immediate violation was the fact that it violated the copyright on the picture that was taken from the school website, and started taking steps to take it down. And the student, I believe, was disciplined in school via suspension for, I think it was 10 days. So, and this, the student's parents claimed, was a violation of their right to free speech, especially since all of the activity took place outside of school. So, initial reactions to this story?
Well, first, I just have to sort of admire the fact that 14-year-olds these days, when they get upset about figures of authority, even in their school, they take their pitchforks and their burning oil, and they head to the internet, and they set up fake MySpace accounts to either parody or make fun of, you know, whatever they didn't agree with. And I guess the really striking thing about the page that was set up is that there was a lot of insinuation and heavy sexual innuendo on the site that suggested that the principal was some sort of pedophile, and that he was very sexually promiscuous, and you know, it implicated his wife as well and his duties as a principal. I think that even the URL on MySpace was myspace.com/kidsrockmybed. So even the URL itself was pretty suggestive on the sexual side, and it on a number of different levels, not just the copyright one for taking the image from the school's website. What you're looking at here is a type of speech and expression which really approximates almost defamatory speech, or at least there's a strong argument that there is defamatory speech here. That said, you know, this case is all about how far outside of the boundaries of the school's campus can the disciplinary actions of the school then reach. And there's been a number of cases in the past which talk about how far outside the campus then that the school can discipline a child for in terms of the types of actions that they do.
Yeah, so I guess the claim here was that the making of this MySpace page disrupted school activities enough so that it actually was warranted for to have in-school punishment, namely that there was a lot of classes that were talking about this and the teachers had to quiet them down, and also that the, I guess, when the students returned from their suspension, there was, some students flocked to them and decorated their lockers, congratulating them for their triumph over the man. But interestingly, none of this, what the page viewing actually took place in the school, because MySpace is blocked on all of these school computers, that is, except for the principal's school computer, which apparently does not have those blocks on it.
Right. I do want to add one thing, though, that the ultimate decision that the court made, and in this case it was a divided panel. Two judges said that, you know, the actions that the principal took were okay, and one judge said that the actions the principal took weren't okay. But the actual decision wasn't based on those disruptions of school activity. So according to Supreme Court law, you need to have a substantial disruption of school activity in order to justify this type of in order to justify any punishment for school activity, or we'll say that for now. But what the court relied upon was essentially the principal's, you know, good judgment that if he didn't do something about this immediately, there would have been harsher repercussions. And the court went so far as to say that those things, you know, the fact that students decorate a locker, the fact that kids were chatting in classrooms about this, the fact that, you know, they had to rearrange somebody's schedule so that somebody could sit in, they had to get somebody else to proctor a test while somebody else sat in on a meeting that they were having about this, those were not substantial enough disruptions of school activity to justify any type of punishment based on speech that happened outside of school.
So maybe I missed it. What was the decision based on, if not those?
It was based on the fact that the principal thought, and the court said had good reason to think, that if he hadn't done something immediately, there would have been substantial disruptions of school activity. There would have been, you know, worse things to come.
So the big thing here is, I mean, these days, probably unlike when we were in middle school, the internet has such a strong force, even in the classroom, and even though kids know each other, like, from school and stuff, they're interacting probably constantly outside of the classroom on the internet. And, you know, some people are suggesting that the internet is just so far removed from the classroom that it shouldn't, you know, disciplinary action shouldn't extend unless it's some sort of official school activities that are going on the internet. But the court seemed to take the opposing position, which is that just because it happened on the internet, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily outside the boundaries of what, you know, an area that the school can discipline students on. And more striking here too is the fact that this it dealt with a school official, this principal, and all of this stuff seemed to generate at least a fairly strong response from all of the student bodies. You know, if I'm pretty sure that everybody was talking about this when it came up, and especially after the student had been suspended, probably everyone was aware of the reasons of why she had been suspended. It was, you know, one of those hot gossip topics that everyone was talking about. So, I mean, personally, legal principles aside, I could probably acknowledge the fact that this was causing at least some measure of disruption on the school's campus.
Yeah, but the issue that the court had was that this wasn't enough disruption. And when this first broke, my initial thoughts were, you know, if you kids are talking about something in class, that could be anything. That could be, you know, the last episode of Lost. You know, people decorate lockers for birthdays. This isn't the type of substantial disruption that you want to be able to suspend people for. You know, it's that's the kind of, you know, if speech is causing that minor of an effect, you shouldn't. Schools should not have the right to kick people out of school for that. And the court, I think, agrees with that, saying that, you know, that's pretty minor compared to what the actual problem was here.
That said, though, do we really want to allow students to have this additional channel of communication in order to make comments like this about school officials and not have the school be able to? I mean, from the judges' perspectives, do we really want just the parents to be able to handle this situation? Or should it be one that the school can, you know, kind of bring in their iron fist to?
Is there an option, could this have been made a personal matter instead, where the principal sued the student or student's family directly for this, and it had not been a school issue? Or is that too far?
No, it's not, because like I mentioned before, I mean, I think that the speech and expression that was going on the website already approximated defamatory speech to begin with. And, there's some arguments that it was just a parody and that this was one student's way of expressing themselves. So, and I didn't follow the case as it came up through the district court, and I'm not really aware of what the other claims might have been. But you also mentioned that there was a copyright claim in the case for using the picture on the school's website. And this is a fake MySpace profile, and on the terms of service agreements for most of these social networking sites, you almost always have terms which, you know, basically require you to either warrant or to be at least truthful when you're posting material online. And if you're going to create an account, you are sort of deeming yourself to be the owner of that account. Again, I think there might have been other arguments, though, that if the principal's name wasn't used on the MySpace account, then, you know, maybe it would have been difficult to pin down. But there were other things like references to the wife and his kids, and certainly the picture from the school's website probably would go in the other direction.
Yeah, I think there would have been legitimate defamation claims, probably also a legitimate harassment claim, criminal count against the students for this activity.
I do know, really quick though, that it started off as a publicly accessible MySpace account, and then later that the students who created this account turned it into a private account, and according to the opinion, I think they gave access to about 22 other students or individuals after they had made it private.
And so what effect does that really have, other than sort of limiting the speech, the reach of the speech, I guess?
None really for the defamation claims, because all that the defamation standards really require is a publication to a third party. And so, first of all, it was made available to everybody before it was taken private, so that already hurts any arguments you have against that this allegedly defamatory speech was not published to a third party. And even after it was made private, it was then made available to an additional 22 people. And, you know, I'm sure that out of those 22 people, who everybody in the school probably knew, everyone was probably trying to see the profile and try to see what was written on the site.
Yeah, and the principal did have to eventually go through a student in order to access the site, the student who informed him of the website's existence in the first place. So, he had ways of finding out one way or another. Dominic, any thoughts on this?
No, pretty much all set.
Just silently weeping for our culture over there?
Yeah, I think it's actually kind of a sad case.
There is one other thing that I want to mention, if we weren't going to get to it otherwise, which is that the same day the Third Circuit released the case that we just talked about, they released another case that dealt with very similar facts. The speech was slightly less defamatory in the second case than it was in the first case, but in the second case, the court said that the student couldn't be punished for what he said outside of school because the school essentially conceded the fact that there was no substantial disruption of school activities. And the facts were very similar to what they were in the other case, as far as, you know, the results of what happened. And I thought that was very interesting that, you know, the school, for starters, it was a tactical mistake to concede that there was no substantial disruption of school activities. And secondly, you know, it kind of reinforces the fact that little things like that do not rise to the level of substantial disruption.
All right. Any last thoughts?
I'm good. David O'Brien.
None on my end.
All right. So with that, we'll move on to our third story today, which has to do with new rules for jury duty. So the Judicial Conference Committee on Court Administration and Case Management, a.k.a. CACM, at their December 2009 meeting, drafted a new set of instructions that judges should give to jurors during cases by jury. And those instructions essentially outline more strictly what exactly you can and cannot do during jury duty, so specifically pertaining to various online services. So quoting from the instructions here, you also must not talk to anyone about this case or use tools to communicate electronically with anyone about the case. This includes your family and friends. You may not communicate with anyone about the case on your cell phone, through email, BlackBerry, iPhone, text messaging, or on Twitter, through any blog or website, through any internet chat room, or by way of any other social networking websites, including Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, and YouTube. So, end quote. So, according to these new rules, I guess live blogging court cases from jury duty is out, especially if you're going to be doing it via YouTube. So, are these necessary? I mean, that's sort of implied about not talking to anyone. Is it necessary to not talk to anyone via LinkedIn?
Well, first thing to note is that these judicial committees, which are established at least in part by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which is, of course, Justice Roberts.
I'm sorry to interrupt. That'd be Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts.
Yes, well, that's a very important distinction because everyone usually thinks of the Chief Justice, Chief Justice Roberts, as being the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He does, in fact, have many other responsibilities aside from his in his capacity as being on the Supreme Court, and that would include governing some of these councils and committees which establish policies and guidelines that will apply to all U.S. federal district courts, or all U.S. federal courts, excuse me. And so, first thing to note is that this is an advisory committee, and that these rules are not they don't necessarily carry any kind of precedential weight. It's more like that they, as far as I know at least, it's more like that these are heavily suggested jury instructions to give. Now, that said, though, historically, judges in federal courts and state courts to commonly give these instructions to jury members. This sort of just outlines a very strong policy way of implementing these instructions as you give them to the jury at the outset of a case after the jury has been impaneled. And so it's not like they have to follow them, but I think for the most part, these rules don't change anything. It gives judges a way of articulating what to do and what you're not allowed to do. And it specifies very clearly in these proposed instructions that the communication is not allowed as it pertains to the case itself, not to just any kind of communication between jurors. And this is interesting because we talked about it a few weeks back on the show when there was a bunch of cases that came through, I think both in state courts and maybe one or two in federal courts that involved jury members doing research on Wikipedia or on other sites and communicating with each other over Facebook. And again, these are all policies which have been in place for a long period of time, that jury members are not supposed to communicate with each other outside of the courtroom. All the communication is supposed to go on, you know, while they're impaneled or as the case goes to deliberation. And so all of the jurors can have the benefit of communicating together as a whole, because that's how they're supposed to come to decisions. And it goes along with the research elements too, and that's that the jury is only supposed to consider the evidence as it is presented to them by the attorneys in the case.
And I think Dave just covered absolutely everything we could have to say about this story. Well done, sir. In one breath, nonetheless.
That was a long breath. But, you know, I don't think that it is terribly interesting. It's definitely not surprising that this committee came up with these proposed jury instructions. I think they're pretty thorough, and I think it explains and reiterates several times over, if you read the entire instructions, which consists of 3 or 4 paragraphs, you know, they try to cover each and every basis of what is acceptable communication and what is not acceptable communication. Mostly they do that through just negative language, saying you're not allowed to communicate about this as it pertains to the case. You're not allowed to communicate about this to people that aren't jury members, you know, outside of the courtroom. You're not allowed to conduct research as it pertains to the case. Nowhere in there, though, does it say that you're not allowed to communicate with other jury members on a personal level. So maybe that part alone is interesting, and it's more interesting about what the proposed instructions do not say than what they actually do say, being that it doesn't seem to prohibit jurors from, you know, adding each other as friends on Facebook, which is something that we saw in one of those previous cases that showed some sort of impropriety on the part of the jury members. And attorneys in that particular case tried to basically invalidate the verdict that the jury had reached because there was some sense of impropriety that the jurors had been communicating with each other outside of the courtroom. But, you know, again, it's sort of left up to a judge's discretion, an individual judge's discretion in a particular case. If you have a couple of jury members that are commuting outside of the courtroom on one of those social networking sites, even if it doesn't pertain to the case, the judge might still decide that that alone is enough to invalidate their verdict or cause some sort of reason to have a completely new trial because the jury's been tainted in some way. But, you know, We'll have to see where this goes and how courts treat it. And I am convinced, though, that this will continue to be an issue into the future, as you know, everybody is on the internet, everybody does their own research, and they all communicate, so it seems, on social networking sites. So it's pretty hard to avoid this issue.
As a complete tangent, if I were one of those people who had like the special life recording pieces of technology, so I constantly had a video camera that was broadcasting on the web what I was doing at any particular time, would that be reason enough to be released from jury duty?
Absolutely. To have a video camera that you brought into the courtroom that was broadcasting video and audio feed at the same time?
That would probably be a reason to have you turn off the camera and serve the jury.
No, there was a recent case, too. I think it involved, who's the famous, is the weather guy, is it Al Roken? I can't remember his name.
Roker?
Yeah, he was recently impaneled on a jury, and he was posting updates about his impanelment to either a blog or to Twitter or something like that. He was tweeting about what he was doing on the jury, and he was immediately kicked off the jury. I mean, the local rules very clearly establish in almost all federal jurisdictions that there are to be no cameras in the courtroom without the express consent of the judge, and absolutely no video feeds, no audio capturing. So any of that stuff is definitely room to kick a person off of a jury. It's probably not enough to kick off the entire jury. That would really depend on the circumstances, though.
Sure, but I'm looking at this more from the perspective of jury selection. Like, I don't think it'll, if you say, oh, well, I'm life-logging right now.
Well, if a person hasn't been impaneled on a jury yet, you know, that's probably not enough to get you out of jury duty. But if you have a case that has already started, say it's a case that's scheduled to go on for a week or two, you're a week into the case, and someone finds out that one of the jury members is, you know, posting stuff about the case and maybe his personal thoughts, or he's posting audio feed that has to do with the arguments that are proceeding in court, that is more than enough usually to kick a person right off the jury, and it also might be reason enough to have a new trial.
That's true.
All right, last thoughts?
Someone's got to have more thoughts on this. I can't be the only one that talks on this.
No, I mean, I think you've just about covered it. There isn't a whole... It's interesting because it's the court finally speaking out on this and making a specific, you know, specific jury instruction to deal with this new form of communication. But in the overall scheme of things, it's not new in that, you know, there's always been this prohibition on sitting jurors talking about a case, you know, while it's ongoing. So in that sense, I don't think it's new.
And, you know, just to note, I mean, being a jury member is entirely different than being a member of the public that's sitting in the spectator gallery watching a case. Again, those local rules also apply, you know, that govern usage of audio and video recording equipment or electronic devices in general, will also apply to spectators in the courtroom, and it's always within a judge's within the judge's discretion to kick those people out or not allow those types of devices. But it's an entirely different proposition when it's jurors doing it on the case. So it's not that all courts, especially not state courts, that state courts commonly allow video cameras in the courtroom and people taking pictures, but the federal courts, on the other hand, do not or have not historically allowed those for some time now. So, you know, entirely different, though, if you're a jury member, and it's almost always reason enough to cause some sort of appearance of impropriety that would be reason enough to kick a person off a jury.
Anybody else have thoughts on this before we wrap it up for the week?
I look forward to the future, far, far away, where every courtroom is streamed live on the internet.
There are plenty of strong movements out there of people that would like to see more transparency in the courtroom, and given, you know, the progresses that we've seen in technology these days and how unobtrusive it is to have audio and video recording equipment in the courtroom, I mean, that's not necessarily something that I'm entirely against, although there are particular circumstances or scenarios where that might not be what you want as an attorney trying a case. That said, though, who knows what we'll see down the line, and maybe there'll be some more transparency in the courtroom, especially the federal courts.
All right, well, with that, I think we'll wrap up for the week. Thanks for listening. With me this week was...
Dominic Rabier.
Ben Snakeoff.
And David O'Brien.
And I'm David Liu. If you'd like to contact us, please visit us at technicallylegal.org, or you can leave comments for us on Twitter at TechLegal, and just be sure not to do that during jury duty. All right, thank you very much.